Sweet. Hello. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Aftermath. Hope you all had a good evening, a good afternoon, a good weekend. Hope you enjoyed UFC London. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk for a couple of minutes about the fights from the weekend. I'm going to show you a couple of bits, one from UFC London and a couple from other shows that you might not have seen, a couple of nice little finishes. And then I'll answer some of your questions. I'll chat to you guys for a little while, see what you want to know, what you want to talk about. Overall, it was a really good card. There were a lot of very competitive fights, a lot of decisions, a lot of very kind of back and forth, you know, people winning a round and then losing a round. Or, I mean, like, you know, starting off with Dalby against Claudio Silva, you know, Silva really looked strong at times, but Dalby just, you know, conditioning. I think I said it on the Picks podcast, the difference being his mobility and his conditioning. Jai Herbert had to work hard for his decision, as did Muhammad Mokaev, you know, really impressive. Of course, breaking the record for takedowns in the division, constantly was trying to chase the back and was unable to. And you've got to give a credit to Charles Johnson for his defense. I mean, it was really, really good. A lot of the time, especially in a UFC debut with someone that's constantly on your back and slowing the fight down, and you know, you want to break free and deliver. You know, sometimes people in that situation, they can do reckless things and they can open themselves up and get caught. And he didn't. You know, I mean, you can tell he's got some experience, you know, not only in MMA, but in boxing as well. It was a hard fought victory for Mokaev. He dominated it, of course, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't go his way for sure. It didn't go the way he wanted to, for sure. He definitely wanted a submission. Outstanding wrestling, though, you know, outstanding control all the way through it. I mean, he's such a bright prospect. I mean, he's 7-0 now. Really, really impressive. Okay, who else? Nathaniel Wood looked better than I've ever seen him. So we saw Nathaniel a couple of weeks ago, probably one of his last sparring sessions at GB Top Team. He looked better last night than he did in his sparring sessions. He had some really good sparring sessions. It's a real credit to his gym. He's got some people there that can push him on that mat. You know, guys that are fighting in Cage Warriors now, guys like Lona Kavanagh and Kingsley Crawford, you know, really good fighters that are able to push him. You could just see the level that he was at in comparison to Charles Rosa. He was leagues ahead. Quicker, more athletic, way more comfortable at that weight class as well. You know, something that is worth noting for any fighters that are kind of a bit stuck between two weight classes. You know, just because you can make a weight doesn't mean you should, doesn't mean it's going to be the best weight class for you. I think he looked really good. And he always looked a step ahead of Charles Rosa. And that, you know, might be something to do with the fact that Brad has trained with him, and Gekasey's, I think, trained alongside Rosa as well. You know, they obviously knew how to deal with his style and what to expect. You know, be aware of the counter punches. Once you've landed a couple, make sure you're out of the way so you don't receive those wild counters. Very, very impressed with him. As I was with Mark Gekasey, obviously it's not the fight that some of the fans wanted, but you know, he's building himself back up here. He's finding his feet at a new gym and adding new things to his game. And I think once he gets that comfort that he can control people and take them down and wrestle with them, we're going to either start seeing him adding ground and pound or submissions to the end of that, or just returning to his striking where, you know, he can dictate the pace. And if he wants to ground the fight, he can. Who else? I mean, you know, Clive Mason Jones, another banger. You know, fights that we talked about on the Picks podcast, you know, being potential fight of the night. It's that middle part of the card was always going to be very strong with those guys matched up. Paul Craig's fight was a weird one. And I'm sure I get a couple of questions about it anyway. But I mean, you know, Paul's a very, very skilled fighter. But the way that he fights is, and I think one of the commentators referred to it as a throwback style. The reason why they say that is because, you know, you go back to Hoyce Gracie times, he was fighting off of his back. He was using jiu-jitsu to submit people. But that was partly down to necessity because he was not as big as the people that he was fighting. My understanding of Gracie jiu-jitsu, of guard playing, is that it's always the secondary plan. Like, you always want a primary game. You don't want to walk out and lay down. You know, you want to put people in a position where they have to deal with you being oppressive in top position. I mean, and again, this is just my perspective, and I do want to kind of discuss this with you today because I'm interested to hear people's thoughts. I feel like Paul needs to build out the primary aspects of his game. His striking has definitely gotten better. That was a definite improvement I saw and definitely confidence. And I think if he watches the fight back, he'll realize how much success he was having and how well he was landing. If he adds in an offensive wrestling game and he can force people to the floor, then he's going to be really, really problematic. But as soon as people are able to shut down that pull to the ground style that he has, it starts to for me to look like he's becoming defeated even when he's not. It's a challenge, you know. If you're a counter striker, generally you're on the back foot and you're moving away, and you've got to be a lot more impressive with your counter striking than the person moving forward and throwing more wild punches. It's just the nature of judging. It's, you know, you have to have a really good judge that understands the back and forth of striking and the space control to understand that, you know, you can be backing up and counter striking and being winning and winning the fight and having octagon control. You don't necessarily have to be moving forward. It can be the same on the ground. You know, some fighters are really offensive off their back. But I always would want, especially one of my fighters, I would want them to have the ability to physically force you into positions that you don't want to be. That for me is the aspect of mixed martial arts that has taken precedence in the last few years. Like the style that Royce Gracie had, the kind of like a plan B style, like I can't physically do that to you. I'm going to do this instead. It's like a fallback plan. And I just don't think it doesn't look very dominant. I feel like Paul could add a few things to his game that would make him really, really problematic. And I think it also gives his opponents confidence when he starts to, you know, pull guard and dive for ankles and they're able to get free. You know, each time he gets back up off the canvas, to me, that would build confidence in, if I was his opponent. Just, you know, my personal thought, but it's very, very difficult to win a fight with that kind of style. And I think, you know, the likes of Ankalaev, who, you know, beat him for nearly 15 minutes. Like that's the kind of start. Like I think if they fought each other 10 times, I think Ankalaev would probably do that to him every time. And this one time he's going to get snagged in a triangle in the last minute. I just don't think it happens very often. And I think all the time while Paul's on his back trying to fight off his back, in the judge's eyes, he's losing because he's not got top position. It's a very difficult style to impress with. Anybody tuned into Jamie?
Yeah, we've got.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Hello, 611 people that are around on a Sunday afternoon to sit and listen to me talk nonsense. Okay, so let's talk about Molly McCann. What a performance it was. She looked more composed than I've ever seen her before. You know, even after the victory, you know, she had a little run where she darted over the fence and tried to get past as many security guards as possible. I did love that. And then when she got back into the octagon and they were announcing her as the winner, she was very kind of calm and matter of fact. And it for me, it's a different version of Molly. Like she seemed to be like, it was almost like she was in command of the space. Like she wasn't surprised that she was there with her arm being raised, which was a lot. I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but I'd like to know what was on her mind in that moment, because I would imagine it was quite profound. And the performance was great as well. You know, we all expected Hannah Goldie to try and get a hold of Molly, of course, but Molly's takedown defense was great. She was doing this really nice thing where as Goldie was in on a single leg, she was trying to run her leg up, and Molly was just jumping, doing these long hops where she was drifting away. And something similar to Molly's fight and Paddy's fight is that there was a strike in both where there was a clear change in the direction of the fight. Molly's was a far more one-sided throughout the fight, in my opinion, than Paddy's was. You know, that was kind of back and forth at moments, and you know, Paddy was defending takedowns and trying to get off the fence and stuff. There was a point where she defended a takedown and she hit Hannah Goldie with this short range elbow, and Goldie kind of stepped back a little second. And again, in that moment, that's where Molly would normally have gone charging forward and gone a bit wild, and she didn't. You know, she walked her down. Goldie obviously tried to go for her ankle, and Molly denied her, called her back to her feet. And then as soon as she was back up, she jumped on her straight away. And you know, and that finishing flurry where she, you know, she steps across to set the spinning elbow up again. Beautiful. She seems a lot more calm, a lot more mature, and a lot more confident in herself, and not surprised about the fact that she's, you know, she's in the UFC competing on the main card in the O2 Arena. It was a really good performance. I mean, I was very impressed with it, and I think she gets better each time out. I'm interested to see what they do with her next and how they match her next, because you know they're going to start to really step her opponents up soon, especially because she's got such a fan base. They're going to want to start, you know, progressing her towards the bigger fights in the division. Okay. In fact, let me have a quick look at that division. They've not updated it yet, surely. Yeah, I mean, there's a few fights ahead of her. There's some tough ones there. Give me some shouts. Give me some mentions in the comments who you'd like to see Molly fight next. I'm interested to see who you'd match her up with. Krylov against Gustafsson did not go how I was expecting. I wasn't necessarily surprised that Krylov was able to land such clean punches, but I think maybe there was a little bit of wishful thinking that Gustafsson, especially coming back down at 205, that he was going to be somewhat back to his old self. But he just seemed to get clipped, and I don't know, he just didn't seem to be able to withstand a great deal. It was a bit of a disappointing outing, to be honest. I'm sure he had a lot more expectations of himself. Krylov, you know, he's that guy. I always say he's that difficult guy in the division that they can put in there, expecting the person that they're putting in there to be able to beat him, like they did with Johnny Walker. I fully expected that was in the UFC's mind. It was set up for Johnny Walker to have a spectacular victory, and he just spoils the party. He might be someone to keep an eye on in this division. And I don't know about Gustafsson. I saw Daniel Cormier tweeted about the fact that he needs to retire. I think obviously that's his decision. He needs to understand what went wrong and why, and you know maybe figure out if he does really genuinely want to continue. Because of course he's a very skilled individual, but he's never going to get easy fights, is he? Let's be honest. Okay, right. Let me stop talking and show you this finish, because it was wicked. So Paddy Pimblett, of course, has completely stole the show. Not only with his performance, but his post fight interview. You know, the way he's conducted himself and the way he's worded things and the things he's mentioned, things he's spoken out about, just overall very, very impressed with him. You know, just like Molly McCann, they have stepped up their level of professionalism. I'm very impressed with them, you know, especially considering, I mean, of course, you know, he gained a bunch of weight and has made a bunch of jokes about it. But you have to also remember the discipline that it takes to get that weight off at the speed that he did and to come in that kind of condition. It's a credit to him and a credit to his nutritionist, Paul Reed. It's, you know, I would like him to stay closer to the weight and you know, work on his S&C, because the higher up in this division he gets, the more brutal these lightweights get. And that's the one thing you have to bear in mind about this division, is it is an absolute shark tank. You know, everyone in the top 15 is a real handful. Most of them can wrestle, and if they can't wrestle, then they can stop you wrestling them. I would like to see him, you know, gradually progress, but you've got to think, I mean, he's what, 22 fights into his pro record now. The UFC might try and push him, accelerate him a little bit quickly. I hope they don't, because I think they could build him into something. And of course he speaks very well. But his skills also speak for themselves. Okay, let me show you this. So as I was saying about the McCann fight, there was a short elbow that kind of started the tumbling towards the end for me, and it was the same thing with Paddy fight. So Levitt had level changed. Where are we? Levitt had level changed, and he was in on this single leg, and you can see Paddy, he brings his right arm to his bicep, and he sets up like a reverse anaconda position. It's a nice little control position. You can see as he brings his arm up to the arm of Levitt, he kind of locks it in with his chin as well, like he does with his rear-naked choke. There you go. He locks his chin over. Now, this is not a finishing position. It's potentially uncomfortable, but it's not gonna get a submission from Jordan Levitt. He might have had a better chance if he had not had the arm in. I got the impression that this was something that Paddy had drilled, and he knows, and this is a sequence that he's familiar with. He knows that he can control people in this position. And the knee that he landed was for me the beginning of the end. It was the start of the tumbling of Jordan Levitt. And what's really nice is he switches his feet, so he pulls his power leg back so he can drive it straight into the side of the head. So here comes the knee. right in the side of the head. And he's, and of course, you've got to bear in mind, he's holding Levitt in this position as well. So he's taking the full force of that knee. And then, you know, he's dazed. Paddy's on top of him. And then Paddy's going to chase around to his back once they land. And as he chases around to his back, he collects this arm. You can see Paddy's got a lock over that. And he's also got the body triangle on, which makes it even more difficult for Levitt to move. And one other thing you have to bear in mind is if he's got, because he's got the gloves on, there's a lot more of his hand to get stuck. Like, it's difficult enough to get your hand out of this position if you've got no gloves on. But with a glove, that is getting stuck on the back of the leg of Paddy, and he has got a tight lock on that because he's got a body triangle. Would have been more difficult to control that arm if he just had regular hooks, but the body triangle coupled with the glove, it was going to be incredibly difficult for Levitt to get out of this position. And then you've got Paddy with two arms attacking one arm of Levitt. Now, one of the reasons why Levitt felt he was safe in this position is because he kept his shoulders as square to the mats as he could. You can see that he's quite a lot lower than Paddy. There's Paddy's line of his shoulders and there's Levitt's line of his shoulders. It makes it difficult for Paddy, who really wants Levitt here. He wants him to be, you know, almost side by side head wise, so he can get a good deep bite on that rear naked choke. So Levitt kind of felt like he was a bit safe here, and the way that Paddy pulls this back is really nice. So there's a bit of hand fighting going on. On the left side, both of them are kind of hand fighting left hand. Meanwhile, Paddy's right arm is around the arm of Levitt, but it's not deep enough under his chin for Paddy to start thinking about this attack. Now, in a moment, Paddy's gonna push the left hand down of Levitt, kind of pushing down with both hands. Now Levitt again is feeling very safe in this position, arms still caught. But he feels like he can keep his chin buried just enough and keep his shoulder tucked in just enough to be able to stay out of this rear naked choke. As Paddy gets this lock in, though, he starts to twist his body. So he's now pulling Jordan Levitt onto his side. And this is one of the reasons why, as Jordan Levitt's being twisted, his chin comes up, because it's a natural movement if you start to twist the body up. It's very difficult to draw your chin into your shoulder. It's much easier to bring your head up. And as soon as Paddy gets a bite on this chin, you can see Levitt's got his chin tucked. He feels comfortable that he's going to be safe here. Paddy frees his other arm and then goes for the figure four. But then watch how he makes this adjustment with his shoulders. Watch how he pulls him around. In a minute, you'll see it in a second. That twist. That's the point when Jordan Levitt's chin just pops forward and Paddy's arm goes underneath his neck. You can see how much tighter that is now. And the other thing you've got to bear in mind is that because he's got this body triangle on here, Paddy's also twisting away the opposite way with the body triangle. He's squeezing this and he's twisting the opposite way with the body triangle as he's twisting with the upper body. So he's got that kind of, it's like a wringing out motion, like a wet hand towel. He's twisting away with the body. You know, Eddie Bravo always used to call it the Dan 7, but that was a palm to palm. But the key in that was the body triangle and the twisting motion. And it's a very uncomfortable position. There's a lot of pressure on his ribs. Of course, his arms caught as well, which makes the body triangle even tighter. And then Paddy's whole body is clamped onto this. And here you can see again, if I just remove that arrow, you can see how he's got his chin locked onto the back of his hand. So the one arm of Levitt that's free, that's trying to reach for that hand to pull it down to alleviate the pressure, is now fighting against Paddy's chin being locked into that glove as well. Really, really nice finish. Really nice. And what a squeeze. Little adjustment. And another twist. A little kick of the legs and there's the tap. Very nice. Very nice. Great performance by Paddy. Really excited to see, you know, where he goes next and, you know, and what they do with him. Very disappointing for Tom Aspinall, of course, to have only got, you know, 15 or so seconds out of his main event in this one. But the silver lining is that we've got Paddy Pimblett, and I think you could pretty much build an event around him already. You know, you think about Conor McGregor when he fought Brandao in Dublin, one of the wildest, most chaotic of events that you could have ever gone to. I think if you put Paddy in an arena in or around Liverpool that's within striking distance of that city, it would be absolute bedlam. It would be brilliant. Molly would be on the card as well. You know, you look down the rest of that next generation roster and, you know, you've got guys like Nathan Fletcher, you've got Adam Cullen, you know, really strong fighters all the way down that card. Luke Riley, a kid that weighed in this weekend for Cage Warriors and didn't get the opportunity to compete. Very disappointing. Another real strong talent. You could build a card out. I mean, that could literally be... It could literally be like a next generation defending home kind of card. It would be spectacular. The crowd they would bring in would be intense. And then, you know, on the other side of town, you've got Cowbon as well, and they've got great fighters. There's a lot of gyms within the area. It would be a really good thing. And I think Paddy could definitely carry that, especially if Tom Aspinall's going to be away. And we also don't know what's going on with Darren Till either, and you know, how long he's going to be out. But we've got a new, you know, a guy that can carry main event positions in the UK here with Paddy Pimblett. Really, really excited for him. Jack Manson, Chris Curtis, bit of a frustrating one for Curtis. I know he was incredibly frustrated, but I mean, it was the game that Hermanson was going to play. You know, he's awkward. He's got weird timing. I thought his striking output was quite impressive. If I remember correctly, he's the one that landed the most strikes out of all the fights. Yeah, he was the only person that hit 100 significant strikes in the whole event. The next closest was Nathaniel Wood at 97. A really good output from Hermanson. I would have liked to have seen him try and grapple a bit more, especially earlier on in the fight when they were both dry. We know how good his neck attacks are. But overall, you know, he did what he needed to do. He's holding steady in the division. He's lost a bit of consistency, and of course, that's something that he needs to get back. And I still think this fight's for Chris Curtis out there. I said it before this fight. I would love to see him fight Kelvin Gastelum. I think that would be an absolute banger. You know, two southpaw boxers, both with good takedown defense. I think that one's set to deliver. And of course, the main event, you know, disappointing. But it was good to see him having a beer with each other afterwards in their hotel room. Both real nice guys, and I'm sure that either this fight could be rematched again in the future, or their paths will cross on the way back to the title. Lots of good things going on in the heavyweight division. Cyril Gane, Taito Avassa. I think the winner of that might end up with Curtis Blaydes. Okay, right. What else am I going to show you? A couple of other things happened this weekend. Of course, Cage Warriors 141. I want to show you a couple of bits on that. But there was a submission in one championship. Renier Derrida, the Dutch Knight, defending his middleweight title against Vitali Big Dash. And for those of you that watch the Paddy Pimblett War Room, you'll see the inverted triangle I was talking about with Jordan Levitt. It's a really unusual position. And even more unusual to find someone that's got a nice setup for one. And I feel like in that fight, Levitt was able to set him up for that inverted triangle. But this one from Derrida was a thing of beauty. So I've got to show you. I mean, I'm assuming a lot of you wouldn't have seen it because there's been so many fights going on this weekend. But one championship had a card on Friday afternoon, and it was a pretty good card. Okay, let me show you this. And then we'll circle back to UFC London in a second. Let me just quick blast through this. So this is one for you MMA nerds out there. Big Dash on the bottom. Big Dash is incredibly powerful striker, very, very good submission defense, very aware of how good Derrida is. Derrida on top, 16-0 undefeated, middleweight champ, light heavyweight champ, very, very skilled individual. In my opinion, he could probably be competitive with everybody in the top 15 of the UFC's middleweight division. Of course, this is one championship middleweight, so it's 205, but he would either be able to make 185 or be competitive at light heavyweight as well. Just either way, he's a very skilled individual. And this submission finish was wicked. So he's been beating him up and ground and pounding him, and then he clamps onto this Kimura on the far side. And I think this sequence is something that has been something that he's drilled. Like, he has finishers at different pit stops throughout this. So as he goes for the Kimura here, you'll see he leaves enough space. I think this is intentional. He leaves this window here. He leaves enough space for Big Dash to start to scramble. Realizes he isn't going to, so then he starts to try and get his leg free. Now, in this scramble, he tries to take his back. and Big Dash blocks his hook getting in on this far side where you can see here. Then he misses the arm and he ends up in this position. You'll see it better in the replay in a moment. So he's controlling the wrist here. He's got his shin across the center line, then he's got this leg over the shoulder. In a moment, what you're going to see is he's going to move this left leg to the other side of Big Dash's neck. What a beautiful setup this is. So left leg's going to go over to the other side, and then the right leg's going to kick and fire through and close that inverted triangle. You see how he's pulling on the elbow as well. He's trying to hold Big Dash into this triangle while he's cinching it up. And you can see Big Dash is posting down on this arm because he can feel that that's keeping him with some space here. But as Derrida starts to drive him over, he's able to collapse that elbow down. And this is the point where it starts to get tight. And watch this foot here. Watch how it kind of marches its way across the canvas over here. It just kind of wanders. And that's one thing that's making the triangle very, very tight. See that little walk that he does? And what's weird about this as well is that Big Dash starts to ground and pound. But he's already unconscious at this point. This is like a reactionary. He's caught in a triangle in training and he knows that he can punch somebody in the face a few times because he's in an inverted triangle, but he's punching somebody that's not there in a regular triangle. You see what I mean? There we go. So he's just kind of punching randomly. He's already out at this point. What a beautiful finish that is. Here we go. So clears the leg, tries to get the hook on the far side, but the arm of Big Dash stalls it. Tries to get a triangle, Big Dash stays out of it, tries to pull him into the armbar and doesn't get it. So he settles for this position. Right leg across the chest, left leg over the shoulder. Clears the head, kicks the right leg through, and then clamps onto that inverted triangle at the same time as controlling this elbow around the side so he can keep pulling him into it. And then drives him over. Pushes away. He's got a hook on the far side leg as well, so you can see all the different angles. He's pulling this elbow, he's holding onto this leg, and he's driving away and squeezing that triangle closed. And there it is. Beautiful. Beautiful. Have we got any questions, Jim? Okay, let's take a few questions on UFC London, and then I'll show you Cage Warriors before we finish up.
Cool, yeah. So we had a donation and a question from Caleb Fowler.
Thank you very much.
Does Paddy and Meatball have a legit champ? A legit chance at champ?
Pressure's on here, Jamie. Now you've got a mic. What's the gist? Have they got a legitimate chance of getting to the belt?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
Title aspirations.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think if we're realistic, Molly's got a much better shot than Paddy has, just purely based on the look of the division. I mean, you know, you've got to think how many lightweights you've got to get through to get to the belt. The only other way around it, the only way to kind of circumvent that horrendous, you know, list of contenders that you've got to work your way through is to be incredibly marketable. Now, I mean, of course, you know, McGregor was able to leapfrog a lot of cues because he was very marketable, and Paddy does have that. But that can also work against him because he could get leapfrogged up to the division before he's ready to. It's not like he can't gain the skills that he needs to compete with these guys, and with the chaos that he brings, you know, there's always that possibility that he's going to land something. His best way of doing it is to manage his ability to talk his way into fights and parlay that against, you know, fighting a whole bunch of people that are going to really be problems for him on the way up. Molly on the other side, of course, like, you know, the flyweight division is a lot lighter than the men's lightweight division. I mean, I'm looking at that. I'm thinking, you know, Hebus, Tracy Cortez, Blanchfield, Calvillo might be a good fight. Casey O'Neill when she's back, you know, Macy. But there are a lot of good fights there for Molly. A lot of very winnable fights. But then as you get higher up the division, you get to the Tyler Santoses and the Chukagians, and you know that's when there's going to be a skill deficit that has to be bridged. I think it's perfectly within the capability to do it. But there's definitely work that needs to be done there, because it's just a, you know. It's the Valentina Shevchenko division. You've got her right at the top, and then you've got a couple of fighters just below her that are moderately competitive, but to get to the belt is challenging. To get it off Shevchenko would be very difficult, but to get into the top 15 at lightweight is a challenge. I'm excited to see where they go. I think we need to give them room to develop. And I think if they have that time and that space to develop and they're built correctly, then absolutely they can get to where they want to be.
So we've just had another one from Amberly Rose. What's your take on the Sean and Pete Yan fight? Sean O'Malley, Pete Yan.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because, you know, of course, Sean O'Malley's he's a real character. And this is a good example of, you know, what marketability can do for you. He's been able to work his way into some bigger fights because people desperately want to watch him compete. I mean, the numbers that he was drawing compared to everybody else when he was on the Contender Series was astonishing. You know, there was always a real demand for him to watch him, and it has got him good opportunities, but those opportunities also come with, you know, very tough tests. Now, Peter Yan has got an immense amount of experience throughout his Master of Sports in boxing, throughout his MMA career. You've got to think how many fighters you would have to come up against to be one of the best in Russia. It's so vast, and it's a fighting nation. I mean, you know, Peter Yan's going to be a real tough test for him. He's going to try and be a blunt force trauma with everything that he does, and he's going to fight out a very strong defense, which might make O'Malley feel pressured and force him to work more than he wants to. That's going to be the strength of Peter Yan in this one, is that he does walk into the fire with good defense. The benefit on O'Malley's side is that he does have an opponent that's going to walk into the fire. So as long as he can keep creating space for himself with angles to keep moving so he doesn't get cramped up against the fence, he might be able to sharpshoot him from a distance. And with that, you know, comes his punching power and his accuracy. I'm not putting it past Sean O'Malley. It might be a step too far at this stage, but I do also hold Peter Yan in very high regard. He also can let fights slip away from him sometimes, though. And I think, you know, perhaps controversially, I think he's the best fighter in his division, regardless of who's got the belt. And I think that sometimes it's about him showing up and being determined to prove it. you know, even going back to his ACA fights, ACB fights, you know, he had close fights and he got frustrated and then broke the rules. You know, it's a consistent pattern. He could circumvent that by being more aggressive from the get-go. And I think that would be quite unnerving for Sean O'Malley as well. But I'm excited to see it. It's a good one.
Okay, we've had another question. Same thing pretty much, but Leon Edwards against Usman.
Yeah. Now, their first fight was interesting because, of course, it was a long while ago. So, but they've both got this preconceived conception. I think that Usman's going to feel like he could waste a lot of energy trying to take... trying to take Leon down. And I think Leon's takedown offense, it was good when they faced off the first time, but I think it's a lot better now. And I also think that he's got abilities to create scrambles now that he didn't have the first time around. So even if he does get grounded, his ability to either tie him up and threaten him with strikes or submissions or to get him moving are additional things that Leon's added to his game. Of course, on the other side, Usman is not the same striker that he was the first time around. And he was kind of railroaded into grappling in the last one because, of course, you know, Leon's got the speed advantage and the skill advantage of that range. But the work that Usman's been doing over his past few training camps with Trevor Whitman, the accuracy of that swift jab cross that he's got, that, in my opinion, is probably going to give him the confidence to walk into Leon's range. You know, the thing that will stick out in his mind from Leon's recent fight is the time that Nate clipped him and hurt him. Usman is not expecting for a second that if he was fighting Nate, that would happen. So he's going to be confident that if he can hit Leon, he can hurt him. Leon could also flip it on him, though, and start to try and take him down. You know, because sometimes strong wrestlers do let their wrestling relax a little bit when they're investing a lot in other skills. And because Usman's striking is developing so quickly, you know, something has to give, just a speculation. But, that would be something I'd be thinking if I was Leon. I'm going to come out and I'm going to shoot on him straight away. And just, you know, kind of take him by surprise, give him a little adrenaline dump, make him work in a way that he wasn't expecting to in the first round. you know, might even be able to take him down, might be able to ground him, and then that's a big score on the ego checklist for the fight. I expect Usman to be able to either grind out a very, very frustrating decision holding Leon up against the fence, or we're going to see a shootout and then it's a coin toss. I feel maybe that that Usman's probably got the power advantage though in that exchange. I'm just glad Leon's getting his opportunity. Yeah.
So we've had one regarding the Paul Craig fight.
Okay.
And it's from Sinistral. So Dan, what two or three skills would you add to Paul's skill set if you were in his corner?
I mean, I think whatever he's doing with his striking, he's doing it. You can see that there's a growth in that range. You know, his hands look better, almost to the point when he started to land on Özdemir, he looked surprised. But he looked faster. He looked more accurate. I thought Özdemir looked kind of labored at times, to be honest. I feel like Paul Craig, you know, if he could immediately run it back next weekend and they were both, you know, fresh and uninjured, I think he might be able to make the necessary adjustments within a week. You know, I think he was surprised himself by how well he was landing, to the point where I think it was a bit unnerving for him. I would try and figure out a way of building his confidence in his striking, because I think he could be a lot more dangerous than he currently is. You know, keeping his chin tucked and throwing that straight 1-2 down the pipe and then stitching some kicks onto the end of it. I remember watching him hit pads in, I think it was Australia fight week, and he was warming up, and I remember him hitting these pads and I'm like, geez, if he lets go of one of those tree trunks, he's going to kill someone. But he just doesn't seem to have the confidence to do it a lot. I would also, and it's not a dig, not at all, but I would also like to see him have a more offensive grappling game. Because as good as it is to be able to fight off your back, trying to pull people into your guard, it never looks like a dominant thing to do. It always, to me, looks like too much investment in a backup plan. And I would like to see him have a plan A, which is punch you, kick you, take you to the floor, and then take you back as you escape. Or even if he wants to keep going with his triangles, you know, triangle people from mount, you know. There are other ways to do it without trying to pull people into your guard or steal their shoes. Yeah. Okay. Any more, Jamie? Shall I move on?
There's been a couple regarding, well, would it be too early for a McGregor-Paddy fight?
Yeah, I think so at the moment. I think it's unnecessary to create that situation right now. I think McGregor's like way further into the division, of course, than Paddy is at the moment. And it's, you know, although, I mean, it's always the thing, isn't it? When you've got two people that are such a huge star power, put them together and let's see what happens. That's the kind of fight for me that could happen in a couple of years' time. Like, I think McGregor, if he wants to keep competing, can find himself settled into a division or in between divisions if the UFC allow it, where he can just kind of have those fights that people want to watch, you know, him against Masvidal, him against Usman, him against RDA or whoever. You know, there's a lot of fights that I would watch. Gaethje, Chandler, you know, you name it. They don't always have to be consequential, though. They don't always have to be for a belt or anything like that. And this is an unfortunate habit that I feel the UFC have gotten into. I mean, we're seeing it on UFC 277 with the interim title. Like, I just don't think we need it. I think we can recognize someone as having individual star power and give them an opportunity, a platform to express their skills, you know, without having to attach, you know, belts and titles and stuff to it. I think if McGregor can establish that position in the sport, there are a lot of people that fall into that category, the cowboys of the world, you know, people that are kind of active legends, you know. And Paddy's on his way up these rankings. Give him a couple more years. If he finds his feet in the division, the priority will be the title. But if he doesn't and he's still got this marketability, you know, let's get that McGregor fight on then and get them both a bunch of cash in their pocket. I'm not against it. I just think they're on different trajectories right now. McGregor is very much in a rebuilding position right at the top of the division, and Paddy's very much building up to the, you know, the beginnings of a career as a lightweight. Yeah?
Yeah. We've had a donation and a question from Tossie.
Oh, yeah.
Nathaniel Wood, was him not getting the finish more of a testament to Rose's durability or possibly a sign that he won't have enough strength at 145?
It's more about Rose's durability than anything else. I think a lot of fighters would have crumbled in that situation. You know, he was like, even from the first round, he was struggling with that lead leg, you know, to the point where he was switching and he was uncomfortable in his opposite stance. And I think honestly, a lot of other people would have crumbled. And what I was more impressed with was Nathaniel's ability to stay composed, even though he was teeing off on his opponent. Like, it's difficult to stop yourself and pull out the pocket to avoid those counter punches when you're landing. You know, you throw three or four punches and you land three or four punches. Like, you want to just stay in there and keep going. It's, you know, there's an excitement there. But he didn't. He stopped. He stepped himself out. He was away from the counters. He went back to his low kicks. I'm sure he would have wanted a finish, but I hope he can watch that. And I'm sure that his coaches are all telling him that it was one of the most outstanding performances that I've ever seen by him. As much as we love the fights against Josh Reed, where it's a shootout until someone goes down, you can't build a career off those things and have any kind of longevity. And what we saw from Nathaniel Wood was him deal with a very, very tough customer and beat him up comprehensively without getting hurt. I think a lot of other fighters would have fallen, and I think Nathaniel's found the right weight class, and I think in future other fighters will fall at his feet. And I think he's on a trajectory to something quite special. I'm certainly on board. 1,500 people watching. Hello, everybody, on a Sunday afternoon or wherever you are. Where are you all? Drop in the comments where you're at. I like to see where people are from. I've got it pulled up now, Jimmy. I can see what people are saying. We got any more questions? Shall I show people some Cage Warriors bits?
There's one. Ooh. One from James Lee. Literally put it in now. Would mixed rule setting work for the UFC like it has for ONE? Would love to see a UFC tie fight.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not against it, because I just like any kind of combat sport. But I think the UFC do MMA so well that if they did anything else, it would start to confuse people, you know, especially if you start to have a card where it's mixed and they're wearing the same gloves and it's in the same arena, you know, that can be quite confusing. I think it is confusing for ONE Championship. It's, you know, you switch it on, you see two people standing there with MMA gloves on, and you've got to watch for a minute sometimes to see if somebody goes for a takedown. What I do like when ONE change their arena, like if they're doing big gloves or small gloves striking fights, Muay Thai or kickboxing, then use the ring and then do MMA in the cage, in the circle. I would prefer that, so then it's easier to know what you're watching when you're tuning in. And they have enough events to be able to put that division in there. But, you know, I also don't mind the bounce back and forth between rules. It makes it interesting for the people to watch. I just think it's too late in the day for the UFC to do that now. But we'll see. I think there's a lot of good things going on in MMA right now. And ONE Championship having three different rule sets, well, four including the grappling. Yeah, I don't mind it at all. It's like a martial arts extravaganza. They'll add sumo wrestling onto it as well and get a bit of salt in there. Okay, let me show you a couple of cage warriors. If you've got questions, put them in and Jamie will catalogue them in the necessary order. But in the meantime, I'm going to show you a couple of little finishes from Cage Warriors. So Cage Warriors 141 at the weekend, Friday, 20th anniversary. Happy birthday, Cage Warriors. It's been one of the most prolific events in the world for producing UFC level talent. You know, I mean, Michael Bisping, for example, Joanna, Conor McGregor. I mean, you know, the list goes on. Jimmy Warlett, I think that was his 17th fight on Cage Warriors on Friday. And of course, you know, I've known Jimmy for a long time, been training together. His performance was outstanding. And I just kind of wanted to celebrate it just for a minute and take 2 minutes of your time just to watch this, because, I mean, he's been out for 2.5 years. He's never stopped training all the way through. And he was fighting Daniel Skubinski, who is an incredibly tough individual to deal with. He was on a 12-fight win streak at one point before he picked up a couple of losses. And I really expect him to be able to push Jimmy. Jimmy came in with this supreme mindset, great takedown defense, and within a minute he was able to get Skubinski backed up. And this finishing combination that he landed, how he starts to throw one technique and keeps switching to the next, is high level, very, very high level, as he gets caught with a jab here. So you can see he goes, throws the knee, and then pulls it because he sees Skubinski level change. You don't want to get tangled up, so he pushes him off. Long hook to get him to level change again, onto the uppercut, just misses the uppercut, brings him into a clinch range, left hook, right hand, big knee to the body, look at that big knee to the body, bang. Another right hand on the chin from the knee. Right hand backs him up against the fence, and then this one more clips right across his chin. There it is. Beautiful finish. Really, really strong. I mean, the Cage Warriors welterweight division has always been a pretty strong division. Rhys McKee's got the belt right now, hasn't he? He's just beaten Justin Berlinson for it. You know, you've got Matthias Figlak as well. I mean, the welterweight division has always been a real exciting one. And adding Jimmy to this division is well, I mean, I'm buzzing to watch. Just look at the hand speed here. You've got to think he's, what, 38? He's had 400-odd fights, something mad. This finish, bang, right on the chin. Really nice performance, really strong performance from Jimmy. And then the same thing with the main event. So we had George Hardwick. Oh, here's the replay. In the main event, we had George Hardwick taking on Kyle Driscoll. And it was a tough fight for him because, you know, Hardwick, as he always does, he walks his opponents down and always turns it into a war of attrition. Tends to take a lot of shots, gets bloodied, you know, but he's, I mean, undefeated in this weight class. He's 10-1 in his career. I think his one loss was welterweight. But he's got these wicked body shots that he throws. And Driscoll, he attempted to take him down a bunch of times. Hardwick's takedown offense was very strong. He would wrap his neck up and threaten. It was just a very strong performance from him. And the way that he got the finish, so he drops him, I think it was the third round, he drops him with a left hook to the body. I mean, this is very typical of Hardwick's kind of style. Like, he's chasing his opponents down, cracking them with big power shots, sometimes taking some in return, though. But very, very accurate with that body shot, doubling up the left hook. And what you'll see here is this is the shot that he lands in the... Here we go. This is the shot that he lands in the third round. Bang. Big shot to the ribs. What I love about it is he goes for the big hook to the head. Driscoll blocks it and counters it. So Hardwick stays in the pocket and stays covered as Driscoll throws, what, a two-three punch combination? All at the same time as looking at this target here, keeping an eye on this target in the chaos, and sinks this big left hook in. And a credit to Driscoll, he goes down and he fights through it. He comes out in the fourth round, and then we see the same thing again from Hardwick. Up against the fence, covering, but this time he pumps the hook to the head but doesn't actually throw it and comes straight back, shot to the body. There it is. Pumps the hook to the head, pulls it back, bangs into the body. So it's a beautiful finish. So now he's the lightweight champion, and you know, this is a belt that McGregor used to hold. I would expect Hardwick to have two or three more fights defending, and if he stays the champion through the defenses, we're going to see him on a Cage Warrior, on a UFC London card very soon. So make sure you keep an eye out for him. And his brother, Harry Hardwick, as well, another very talented fighter. So you can see there where he throws the left hook to the body, and Kyle goes to block it high. There's his block. He's gone to cover it with his head, which opens up that target into the midsection. Bang! Sinks it into his stomach. A lovely finish. There it is one more time. Bang. Lovely work. That was a nice finish. I'm excited to see where he goes. He's a very interesting individual. He's got a very game style, and he just wears people down. And then his post-fight interview was hilarious as well. A very very emotionally charged individual, but keeps a lid on it right until the end of the fight, and he's got the win. Yeah, good times. Any other questions, Jamie? Should we wrap it there? We got a question?
We got a couple come through.
Okay.
So obviously, a few people have mentioned Tom as well and his injury.
Yeah.
If there's been any news and stuff on that, but what do you think? What do you think happens, and where do you think it goes from there?
I mean, that looked to me like it was some kind of tear, some kind of rupture, and it looked like it was on the outside of his knee to me. I don't know when he did it or how. I don't know whether it was something that he brought into the fight. I know I've seen a few people looking back at the videos that were posted on Full Reptile channel, you know, to watch his gait, to see how he's walking, see if he's limping. I saw a couple of comments, people saying that he was, but I didn't notice it myself. I will go back and see, but I don't know. I mean, what you have to bear in mind with these colossal individuals, these heavyweight human beings, is that they can be working as hard as they want all the way through training camp and never breach like 95% output. But when it comes to a fight night and it's 100% output, you've got that extra little garnishing of adrenaline on the top that makes everything a bit more fiery. You know, these are the moments where people can like lift a car off a person in an accident situation. You get that additional 10% of scary human strength. That is transferred into everything. And if you've got to imagine, if you've got a chain and one of those links is brittle and you start to twist that chain, there comes a point when the torque is too much and that link will break. And if that was a pre-existing injury and Tom stepped in and threw that kick, that might have been the moment where it had taken all it could. And when he stepped back onto it, that's why his knee folded underneath him. I think, was it Jimmy Crute that had the same kind of thing? Do you remember? I remember Jimmy Crute's knee giving out like that.
Yeah, it was. Was it against Anthony Smith?
Yeah, it might have been.
Yeah, like he had like that drop leg thing, didn't
it? It was weird, wasn't it? Because it kind of bounced with it. It was like it catapulted. Mm. Yeah, it was a very, very unfortunate situation. And you know, I think he'll be back. I mean, you know, he's got time. He's got his age on his side. You know, he's not in a huge rush. If anything, he could do with being slowed down a little bit because, you know, he needs a bit more experience before he gets up to the top of this division. I expect him to be out probably for six months or so at least, you know, recovery, rehab, you know, getting back into training, building his confidence back in his knee, assuming he's going to need a surgery, which I would expect. I don't know. I feel bad for him, but we'll see. We'll keep our fingers crossed for him. If you've not seen the pieces that went up on the Full Reptile channel, make sure you check them out. Him up in the north of England, and or Scotland, wasn't he, with Paul Craig, swimming in the ocean and, you know, being a maniac. Yeah, unfortunate, but he's got a bright future ahead of him still and plenty of time. Yeah. Any more questions?
There's a couple more. So this is just regarding, obviously, Darren Till stepped out of the co-main event at the weekend. So do you think, obviously, going off what's happened, what do you think his shots are at a title again or a title run?
Again, you know, he's got time on his side. You know, he's still got, you know, he's still like a young man. He's not getting on like me. He's got time for a couple more runs if he wants, especially now he's moved up a weight class. That will have extended his ability to compete because, you know, he couldn't have done that welterweight cut over and over again. Now he's at middleweight. He's still got time to grow into this division. And he's very, very marketable. You know, it allows you to leapfrog a lot of people. Like, you know, I mean, let me have a quick look at the middleweight division. Like, if I look at the middleweight division, I'm like, yeah, you could just, like, he could come back in 6 months' time and he could fight anybody in that top 15. And it wouldn't really matter. You could put him in there against Brad Tavares or Dricus du Plessis or, you know, any of those right beneath him in the top 15. And it's a main event fight on a fight night. Very easy to rebuild Darren Till. He speaks well. He's exciting to watch. I just think he needs to be healthy and well when he comes back. And, you know, maybe him and Tom Aspinall can help each other be patient in their rehab, whatever's going on with Darren.
Okay, there was one last one that kind of sparked my interest a little bit. What do you think of the matchup between Umar Nurmagomedov and Ricky Simon?
Simone impressed me tremendously in his last fight. I mean, he's always been a well-rounded individual that was just behind the top elite pack in the division. Of course, Umar has got a fantastic skill set. He's going to be problematic in every range, but I don't know. I don't know whether Nurmagomedov's just a little bit better all around. I think I think Simone is going to be strong enough to be reactive and to be able to keep this fight going. But it might be a little bit like, you know, when Makhachev fought Tsarukyan. And it was a very competitive fight, but Makhachev was always just slightly ahead. I feel like that might be the case here, both with Nurmagomedov's footwork and striking ability and with his ability to continually, you know, wrestle you until you're exhausted. It's a tough fight, I think, but it's one of those that I'll be looking forward to watching. And you know, a good test for Nurmagomedov, you know, Ricky Simon is a respected individual, and it will certainly get the rest of the division's attention if Nurmagomedov wins impressively. Nice. Thank you, everybody, for your time on this Sunday afternoon. I enjoyed the fights last night. Go back and watch Cage Warriors 141. Go back and watch the ONE Championship from the weekend. It was a lot of fun. Some really good finishes, especially on the main card. And UFC 277 this week. We just recorded the War Room, so they'll be up very soon. And we're going to record the Picks podcast in the next day or so. And that will be up on the channel. And then who knows, if you guys want it, we'll do another live stream next Sunday after UFC 277. All right. Good talking to you all. Thanks for your time. See you next time.